Kansas lawmakers return to Topeka this week to kick off the 2018 session. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, What's in Store for the Kansas Legislature? I'm joined by Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal-World and Jonathan Shorman of the Wichita Eagle. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us, Kay.
Good to be here.
This has to be one of the most awkward starts to the legislative session in my recollection. Before we turn to what we expect to happen in the Kansas House and Senate, let's talk about the governor's office. Who's in charge?
That is the question of the day, isn't it? Everybody was expecting Governor Brownback to be gone by this time, and Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier had already started putting his team together. But the Senate, U.S. Senate, failed to vote on Brownback's confirmation to a diplomatic post in the Trump administration before they adjourned the first half of this Congress. So under Senate rules, his nomination gets sent back to the president, and the president has to resubmit it. And as we're sitting here now, we haven't heard whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that Brownback thought that he would have gone through a lot sooner, or at least by now. Back when Trump made the nomination in January, you know, he held a big press conference the next day, kind of gave this valedictory speech and, you know, took questions and kind of waxed poetic about his time as governor. And it really did create the sense that, you know, this was a guy that was going to be gone within a few weeks or a couple months. And so, you know, they did pursue this strategy of letting Collier pick a cabinet secretary, letting him have a lot of leeway in developing the budget. And it really, I was talking to Bob Beatty the other day, this political scientist at Washburn University, and he really told me that, you know, this is something that future governors are going to study. They're not going to want to make this kind of mistake again where they devolve some of their power prematurely.
Governor Brownback has often used the metaphor of a relay race where he's, you know, passing the baton from himself to Lieutenant Governor Collier. To carry the metaphor a little further, if you're a fan of track and field, there's a finite amount of space on the track in which you're allowed to pass that baton. And if you go past a certain line, they call a foul. He's clearly gone past that metaphorical line there. Unfortunately, there's no foul or disqualification as a result of it here, fortunately. You know, it's a very awkward situation. Nobody was expecting him to give the State of the State address. Collier might have been going through a few drafts on his own, but apparently it is going to be the governor, Governor Brownback.
Yeah, so they've made a big the last few days. Brownback's team and Collier's team have kind of had to make a lot of a big deal about, you know, this was Brownback's budget, and then, you know, put out a big release about how Brownback's giving the State of the State and kind of really almost reasserting authority after they had given it up. It's very, very bizarre.
Have either of you talked to Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier about sort of what it's felt like to be displaced?
You know, I think the standard line is that the state has one governor at a time, and he's remained loyal to Governor Brownback and very careful not to step out in front of him and, you know, speak on behalf of his own administration because he doesn't have one yet. So that's been the real awkward part.
Yeah, but you hear, you know, clearly he was preparing to take over. Every so often we hear, you know, kind of speculation about this person or that person had been talked about as being part of Collier's cabinet. You know, this person is going to replace that person when Brownback leaves, that kind of talk. And that some of that has definitely died down over the last couple of weeks as it's become very clear that this is something that's not going to happen for at least a little while.
You know, another interesting part about that is that the makeup of the U.S. Senate has changed since last year. Alabama, in a special election, elected a Democrat over the controversial Republican. And so now there are only 51 Republican votes and effectively 49 Democratic votes, two independents who caucus with the Democrats. So they only need two Republican defections to spike a nomination. And the concern about Brownback has been his record on LGBT rights and his support of what are often called religious freedom bills. You know, he's nominated to be ambassador for international religious freedom. There were a number of bills in the legislature that he seemed to support that never got through. Well, most of them didn't get through, that would essentially have legalized discrimination in the private sector if it's based on deeply held religious beliefs. So that was very controversial, and Democrats in the Senate objected very strongly to that.
Today on KPR Presents, we're previewing the year ahead for Kansas lawmakers. I'm Kay McIntyre, joined by Jonathan Shoreman of the Wichita Eagle and Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal World. I want to turn back to Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier for a moment. One of the complicating factors about his would-be governorship is the fact that he is himself a candidate for governor, and I think was widely expected to use his time as governor as a way to launch his candidacy. How do you see the very crowded race for governor playing into the year ahead?
Well, it's probably not good for Lieutenant Governor Collier. It's hard to come out of the shadows when you're a lieutenant governor, especially when the presumed front runner in the race, Secretary of State Chris Kobach on the Republican side, has such a national profile. We haven't yet seen public polling in the race. We haven't yet seen campaign finance reports. That'll be next week, I believe, to see who's raising how much money. Those will be key indicators when they do start coming out. But right now, I mean, Chris Kobach sucks the oxygen out of the room. And then you have, besides them, you have five other, pretty substantial candidates, including the insurance commissioner, a couple of former representatives, and a millionaire businessman down in Wichita who can probably self-fund his own campaign. So, Collier needs to be able to come out of the shadows and start establishing his own identity, especially for Republican voters. And that's kind of hard to do from the lieutenant governor's office.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that they were hoping to have this, have Collier deliver the State of the State address as, basically a launch pad for his candidacy. And obviously, when you're governor, if he could be governor for most of a year potentially before the election, that offers him the advantages of incumbency. He's on TV, people know his name, he has name recognition. But as it stands right now, it's unclear when he'll actually be able to kind of start accruing those advantages, if at all. And one thing I wanted to point out is the kind of the line coming from his camp over the fall, when they still thought that he would be in place by now, was that, well, we're not going to talk about policy right now. We're not going to talk about my agenda because that'll all be laid out when I become governor, and I'll give the State of the State and it'll all be good. But we're at a point now where he is running for governor. He's not the governor. But we don't actually know what he wants to do as a candidate. So he is not talking as a candidate yet about what his policy agenda is. And it might reach a point where if Brownback, his nomination continues to be held up, they might decide, well, Collier's just going to have to go ahead and start talking about what he wants to do if he is governor, because, if you wait too long, then how are you going to reach voters and you're going to kind of start to encounter problems?
Well, and he's also in a position where he probably wants to distinguish himself from Governor Brownback, who is leaving office as a fairly unpopular governor. And I'm assuming that Lieutenant Governor Collier would like to draw some distinctions between some of the policies of the Brownback administration and what he would like to pursue should he be elected governor.
Oh, especially when you have all the other candidates in both parties essentially referring to the Brownback Collier agenda, the Brownback Collier tax cuts, constantly pairing those two names. They don't want Collier to be able to distance himself from the governor. They want him right where he is. So that's a difficult position for him.
Yeah, so Collier's talked a lot about, setting a new tone kind of whenever he makes appearances and people ask him kind of about this question of how close he is to Brownback. He always talks about, I'm going to listen more to people. We're going to have a new tone. But he can't really get to the point of demonstrating what the new tone looks like if he's kind of kept in this second in command type of position.
There's another aspect of the governor's race that we haven't talked about that could be interesting to watch, is the fact that on the Democratic side, there are two sitting legislators who are both running for the Democratic nomination. House Minority Leader Jim Ward of Wichita, who was kind of seen as the front runner in among the two other candidates who were in the race at the time. And then in early December, with only about 2.5 weeks left in the year, State Senator Laura Kelly of Topeka jumped into the race, apparently and reportedly with the backing of former Governor Kathleen Sebelius, which really changed the dynamics of that race. And so it'll be interesting to see how the Democrats in the House and Senate get along, or who tries to make grandstanding plays out of legislation. That could get very interesting.
One of the other candidates for governor that you mentioned a little earlier, Peter, was, of course, Secretary of State Kris Kobach. Just this week, President Trump announced that he was dissolving his Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, his commission on voter fraud, led by none other than Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. Where does this leave Kris Kobach in terms of his agenda and what he hopes to pursue at this point?
You know, it's hard to tell. I heard him on NPR. His explanation of it was that left-wing groups and left-wing politicians had filed so many lawsuits that the staff of the commission was busy defending these lawsuits and they weren't able to do the work of the commission. And so the job has essentially been transferred to the Department of Homeland Security, which also has people on the left highly concerned. For Kobach, in part, I think being on that commission and essentially being the leader of that commission in everything but name, it was kind of an albatross around his neck. I mean, the other Republicans in the race were criticizing him. His national positions on immigration and on DACA and on these claims that millions of illegal immigrants voted in the 2016 election and that's why Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote, those have been highly controversial. They're popular with his base. He is a routine contributor to Breitbart News. He has regular columns in there. His base loves him for that. And it may be that dissolving the commission might, you know, make him even more of a martyr in their eyes. It might energize them a little bit. But for people who are not part of that nationalist populist base that he has, that commission was highly unpopular.
That is true. I guess my gut reaction when I heard the news was a little bit different than Peter's, in that at least initially my gut reaction was maybe that this is a bit of a loss for him. I agree that, you know, his views on, you know, voter fraud and that kind of thing, it really does fire up his base, and it might actually help contribute to him potentially winning the GOP nomination, although those kind of things would probably hurt him in the general election. But if he were to lose the governor's race, you know, having a national platform like the commission, like being on the commission, leading the commission, those kind of things really help kind of keep alive his and develop his national brand, that if he were to lose the governor's race, it would kind of help him be in a better position for whatever else he wants to do next in terms of being out there, being on TV, you know, kind of being talked about and, you know, being a media presence. I think, you know, I still think he probably won't have any trouble getting on TV, but it might be a little bit more difficult now that he doesn't have this title anymore. And he's just more or less right now, he is just a candidate for governor and the Kansas Secretary of State.
Okay. I'm visiting with Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal World and Jonathan Shorman of the Wichita Eagle. We're previewing the year ahead for Kansas lawmakers. One of the biggest issues lawmakers will face in the 2018 session is school finance. Where do things stand now in terms of how Kansas is funding K through 12 education?
Well, we had a big court decision this fall from the Kansas Supreme Court. Basically, once again, found that courts are not being funded adequately under the Kansas Constitution, and also that the formula that they use to the funding system is inequitable across school districts.
So just to be clear, they found this Kansas Supreme Court found that funding was both inequitable and inadequate.
Well, it gets a little more nuanced than that. What they actually said on the adequacy issue is that the state failed to meet its burden of proof showing that the new formula they enacted last year and the additional money that they put into the formula would meet the standards of adequacy that the court has laid out in previous decisions. I don't want to say, you know, they were basically saying the legislature did a bad job of lawyering, but they had failed to meet their burden of proof. Theoretically, it would be possible to keep the same amount of money and go back in and do a better job of explaining it.
Proving it.
Yeah. But the court kind of suggested, you know, you have a high bar to clear to show that all these other studies suggesting you need upwards of $600 million in additional money each year are wrong, and that you can do it for a lot less than that. So that's kind of where that stands. In terms of the equity issues, and these things get real complicated, it has to do with equalization aid that the state sends to lower wealth districts in order to hold their property taxes down to about the same level as other districts. That can be fixed with some formula changes. That's not a heavy lift. But the adequacy issue, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Peter mentioned some of the estimates range up to $600 million. I think if the legislature found themselves in a situation where they believe that they had to appropriate that amount of money in order to satisfy the court, you're kind of opening a bit of a Pandora's box in terms of how do you get there, because kind of the way our budget is structured and the kind of the revenues that we're bringing in right now as a state, there's no real easy way to get to $600 million in additional revenue to kind of spend on schools right now, absent, you know, significant agency reductions, you know, kind of across the board cuts, which I think most people say won't happen. I don't think there's any appetite for reductions that deep. On the other hand, you have you could go the tax increase route. You know, we just had a major tax fight with Governor Brownback last session. You know, the legislature did override his veto, but, you know, they went a couple rounds with him. It was pretty painful. And I don't, you know, especially from Republicans, you hear there's not really appetite, especially in an election year, to raise taxes significantly again. So you're kind of maybe between a rock and a hard place a little bit. So that's why I think a lot of lawmakers are invested in, like Peter said, providing better justifications for the amount of money they're spending, and maybe, you know, maybe putting in some additional money, but not up to the $600 million level that some people are talking about.
Also, recently, they just hired a pair of consultants to come in and do a study of how much it would cost from a consultant's point of view to satisfy the Supreme Court's adequacy demand. We're expecting that report sometime in mid-March. And so we'll probably get an idea, a better idea at that time. But, you know, Jonathan mentioned the tax increase that they passed last year. That was about $600 million a year in additional revenue for FY18 and fiscal year 19. We're currently in fiscal year 18. The $600 million figure for schools, you're talking about another tax increase of that size.
So that's on top of the tax increase that we got last year.
And that is unlikely. There was a special committee that met in December, and they heard testimony from state agencies. If you were to take $600 million out of all the other state agencies other than K-12 education, because that's where you have to put it, it would amount to about an 18% cut for all other state agencies, including Regents Universities, the University of Kansas, including, you know, the highway program, including, you know, just everything, social services, the Department of Revenue. You know, they would have to take a heavy, heavy cut. And the agencies were basically explaining to the committee that a cut of that size would simply be devastating. You would have to redefine what your universities are here for.
You'd mentioned the possibility of a tax increase and how the legislature had that fight with the governor last year. Would this be a good time to mention that we may have a different governor at the helm should that happen?
Well, that is one of the things, you know, with the Collier discussion is, I think, you know, we anticipated that he would be in place by now. And so this was going to be probably his first major thing that he was going to have to deal with as governor, is kind of working with the legislature on a solution to this. Now you have Brownback very specifically said that his State of the State address will include his solution to the Gannon ruling. We don't know what that is. He won't tell us ahead of time. So now we're going to kind of get a Brownback proposal and not a Collier proposal. Now, to be fair, we don't know how those would have differed if they would have been different. They might have been the same. But it's kind of interesting in the past, in terms of the amount of money, schools should receive from the state. I think, Brownback's been a little bit hands-off in telling the legislature how much money to spend. He's been a fan of saying, at least publicly, the lawmakers are the appropriators, I'm not the appropriators. So it'll be interesting to see if he decides to get a bit more hands-on this time and say, we need to hold the line on spending, or if he has some kind of other solution that might involve some money. I don't know, but I certainly think, at least the stylistically, things will be a bit, the situation will be a bit handled a bit differently if Brownback is kind of the one in charge instead of Collier while this is going on.
Last year, one of the big complaints that you heard from lawmakers in both parties, but Democrats were more willing to go on the record about it, was that the governor wasn't really at the table for very much of the school finance discussion. And he had said early in the session, this is the legislature's job to come up with it, and he did not put out his own school finance plan. You mentioned the hypothetical possibility of a Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier, or of a Governor Collier. I think he would be more collaborative, A, because he tends to be more of a collaborative kind of worker, and B, because he has a huge incentive to collaborate with the legislature because he's a candidate for governor. Last year, President Trump had been elected, and everybody was widely expected to get some sort of federal position appointment. But the 2016 elections also put his faction of the Republican Party essentially out of power in the legislature. Democrats gained how many seats in the House?
Oh, I think it was more than a dozen. Maybe.
Yeah,
about 13. A dozen.
They picked up one in the Senate. But a lot of those social and fiscal conservatives that have dominated the legislature since he came into office, they either were unelected or they decided not to run for re-election. So there was a huge power change. And as a result of that, I think you saw the governor virtually checking out on some of the major debates. He signed that school finance into law sort of under protest. He put out a statement that said he didn't really like it, but that's what the legislature produced. So he went ahead and signed it. I think a Governor Collier would tend to be a little more active, a little more engaged in that.
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind is Governor Brownback this year going to have much sway, if any? Because everyone already knows he wants to leave.
He's got one foot out the door.
Yeah. And so either way, he would be in the last year of his term as governor. So there already starts to be a bit of questions about lame duck status and how much influence does he have. Whereas, if Collier's leading the charge, he could still win the nomination. He could still be governor for another 4 years. So I think, his political clout would probably be less questioned than Brownback's is going to be this year. I think a lot of people are going to be kind of scratching their heads wondering, well, why should we work with him if he might be out on the way out within a few weeks?
One of the things about the school finance issue is it's really exposed a lot of tension between the courts and the legislature. And I know there have been rumors that the legislature may consider a constitutional amendment to limit the court's responsibility. Do you expect that to go anywhere, Peter?
I think that the tension between the court and the legislature really died down after the 2016 election, and a lot more moderate Republicans and Democrats came in, many of whom ran on the campaign theme that we need to do better for public schools and we need to respect the Supreme Court. You might also remember that, was it 2014 or 2016, when five of the seven justices were up for retention, and there were active campaigns to oust them. All five of them got retained. So I think the public sent a message there, and I think the attitude in the legislature is considerably different now. There are still many of Brownback's faction of the party. One has introduced a proposed constitutional amendment that would say local school districts are the only government entity that have the authority to close schools, essentially taking that power away from the Supreme Court. But, you know, there have been constitutional amendments on this issue proposed. They need to have two-thirds majorities in both chambers and then go to a public vote. They couldn't get two-thirds majorities in both chambers, even when the conservatives controlled both chambers. So I think the chances of that are highly unlikely.
Yeah, I would agree. At this point, I have a hard time seeing where you get the votes in both chambers for these proposals. You know, never say never. And it also depends on what would a proposal say. It could be this possible amendment that's already out there. It could be a proposal that would say something else. I would say that I think, you know, the most likely scenario for seeing a constitutional proposal pop up for debate would be if there is a decision by legislative leadership that we need to run a proposal on our respective chambers in order to, you know, kind of allow lawmakers to vent, allow conservatives to get up and say, you know, I can't believe the court did this, you know, we're angry and that kind of thing. And, you know, maybe let them get it out of their system a bit before kind of settling down and kind of preparing how to respond to the issue at hand before the legislature. You know, I think that might be something that, you know, they might consider doing, just allowing them to have the debate, even if they know it's probably not going to pass.
You know, interestingly, Attorney General Derek Schmidt actively encouraged the legislature to at least have that debate. And one of the reasons is the key language in the Constitution that this whole thing centers around, about making suitable provision for finance of the educational interests of the state, that was adopted as part of a comprehensive constitutional amendment dealing with education that voters approved in 1966. And his argument is that when the voters passed that, the Supreme Court has now set down a standard for adequacy called the Roe Standards. It's a set of educational outcomes that were the result of a Kentucky school finance case in the 1980s. And he says it is not theoretically possible that voters in 1966 had in mind that we were going to adopt standards that didn't come into existence until the 1980s. And so maybe it's time to have a new look at this. The one person in state government that I know who was around at that time is Assistant Education Commissioner Dale Dennis. He started at the Education Department, the new Education Department, in 1967, immediately after that vote, and he's been there ever since. And he said the big issue, and you can go back and look at the old newspapers, the big issue was the fact that they were abolishing what used to be county superintendents of public instruction, and they were creating a new state board of education that was elected independently, and the state board would hire an education commissioner, a state commissioner, that would supervise the day-to-day operations of the state. That was the big reorganization, and it came after Kansas had just gone through this gut-wrenching process of school consolidation, creating the system of unified school districts that we now have, that ended up closing schools in a lot of small towns, which then became unincorporated villages. But I digress. Anyway, Derek Schmidt says we should be having this discussion. It would be healthy to have this discussion, whether or not, you know, maybe the voters in 2018 would say, yeah, we like the system we've got and we don't want to change. That would be fine. But it might be time to have this discussion about, you know, what do we want the Constitution to say about this?
Peter Hancock with the Lawrence Journal World, Jonathan Shorman with the Wichita Eagle. I'm Kay McIntyre. We're previewing the year ahead for Kansas lawmakers. Last year, lawmakers approved expanding CanCare, the state's privatized Medicaid system. Governor Brownback vetoed that expansion, and supporters didn't have enough votes to override that veto. Will we expect to see Medicaid expansion come up again this year, Jonathan?
I think it's a fair bet to say that, yeah, supporters will take another run at it, especially, you know, not only because, you know, they believe in the issue, but also because it is an election year and you want to be able to go back to voters and say, we tried again this year. And you know, it's probably fair to say that we'll probably get the same outcome. Just because I don't really see the sands shifting all that much since last year in terms of which lawmakers hold which positions. I think, if there's any movement, it might be around this idea that the federal government kind of tried to overhaul Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and more or less failed. You know, they did repeal the individual mandate, but the bulk of the law is still in place. And I think some opponents of expansion in the past have said, well, you know, the new Republican Congress is going to repeal this and we're going to go to a different system. And that really hasn't happened. So I think that might be the one thing that maybe would cause opponents to kind of reconsider a little bit this year in terms of if they have the sense that the Republican Congress is not going to move on this issue and maybe Kansas should go ahead and get in on some of this federal cash, since this seems to be a thing that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Peter?
You know, the one thing that Congress did accomplish this year as part of the tax overhaul that passed in December was repealing the individual mandate, the law that says virtually all individuals have to carry health insurance or pay a tax penalty. That was repealed, and we're waiting to see what the impact that's going to have on premiums across the board. A lot of people think that'll cause premiums to spike up. But yeah, I mean, you're right. They failed a number of times to repeal and replace Obamacare. I don't remember if any of them even got to the floor of the Senate. But at any rate, now with the addition of one more Democrat, where you have almost even parity between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, the chances of that passing again are highly unlikely. I did talk with House Majority Leader Don Heineman from Western Kansas. And a number of reporters were talking to him, and we asked him, you know, what are the chances of this happening? He seems to think that there is still a great deal of uncertainty about what's going to happen at the federal level. And so the chances of that bill getting through, he thinks, are kind of slim. But people thought that last year, and they almost had the 2/3 majority to override the governor's veto on it.
Well, and again, let me point out that we may have a different governor. What are Jeff Colyer's views on Medicaid expansion?
Well, Colyer seems to be generally opposed, like Brownback. But in his case, Medicaid and CanCare have kind of been a bit of kind of his baby while he's been lieutenant governor. He really spearheaded the creation of CanCare back in 2012 and 2013. He was kind of the public face of the administration, talking about that a lot. And that's kind of his field of expertise, and he's really good about the details and kind of getting in the weeds of that. So I think, you know, if the legislature did want to approach this issue, there might be a possibility that maybe they could maybe have a little bit more room for negotiation with Colyer potentially, because this is a topic that he's really interested in and someone who would be very conversant in the details of, and maybe, I don't know, it's always possible, maybe there would be room for some kind of deal that could potentially expand eligibility for the program, but maybe have expanded work requirements on some of those individuals, or have other kind of conditions as part of getting onto Medicaid. But, you know, right now it seems like there's not a whole lot of daylight at the moment between Brownback's position on Medicaid and Colyer's position.
I think if there's one issue that defines Jeff Colyer right now, is that he is a policy wonk on health care. And he was vehemently opposed to Obamacare when it passed. He remains so today. He remains opposed to expanding Medicaid. He was the principal architect of CanCare, which was the state's program to essentially privatize the Medicaid program, handing over management of it to private for-profit insurance companies who are just paid a capitated rate, a per-patient rate, to manage people's health care and get a profit off of that. Reviews are mixed on how well that has worked. There, suffice it to say that the federal government had a lot of problems with it, and early last year declined to renew the waiver that allowed the state to do that. They've since gotten that approval. But this is what he's known for, and his position is crystal clear. He is opposed to expanding Medicaid.
Again, today on KPR Presents, we're previewing the year ahead for Kansas lawmakers. I'm Kay McIntyre, joined by Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal-World and Jonathan Shorman of the Wichita Eagle. The state's foster care system has faced renewed scrutiny in the past year. The Department of Children and Families, DCF, has a new secretary. We have record numbers of children in foster care, some reports that the number of kids, runaways, that are missing from the foster care system is unclear. What do we think lawmakers will do to address some of the problems in the foster care system? Jonathan?
Well, they convened a kind of a task force, a child welfare task force that met throughout the fall. And kind of wrapped up without, as far as I can tell, without, I don't think they produced any clear recommendations yet. But they did hear a lot of data. That's kind of where some of these revelations came from, this idea that, you know, we heard earlier in the fall that there's about somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 missing children who are part of the foster care system. Most of them are runaways. You know, officials say that's more or less in line with the national average, but it was still kind of it's not a public thing, and it was shocking to hear it when it came out. So I think there will be a lot of focus, probably on how do we maybe increase oversight over the foster care system? How do we ensure that there's kind of regular checks on how well we're doing things? You know, foster care is always going to be. It's probably going to be one of the functions of government that's most closely scrutinized, just because of it deals with children. It deals with some of our most vulnerable citizens. So, you know, there's always going to be stories about foster care. There's always going to be attention to it. But I think lawmakers want to, you know, make sure are our social workers being paid well? Are they, you know, equipped to do what they can in the field? You know, you mentioned a new secretary, Gina Meyer-Hummel, who I believe ran some kind of agency here in Lawrence before she was selected for that position. Oh, and by the way, going back to Collier, that was a Collier pick. That was the one cabinet secretary they allowed Collier to pick and kind of roll out back before, you know, the holdup happened. But, you know, I think right now there's a lot of optimism about her from lawmakers. So I think they're paying close attention to see if, you know, is she going to deliver on kind of what she's saying. She's, you know, saying they're going to step up efforts to try to find these missing children and kind of have a top to bottom review. So I think people are really watching and see what kind of performance does she put in.
You know, Jonathan mentioned those 70 some odd missing children. That was the number at one time during a committee meeting. That was probably the straw that broke the camel's back and forced then Secretary Phyllis Gilmore out of her job. It may be true that, you know, having 1% of your foster care population running away or missing at any given time is within national standards or national norms. But to hear the secretary of your child welfare agency speak before a legislative committee and essentially say, yeah, it's no big deal, we're not that concerned about it, which is what many lawmakers heard when she addressed the issue, that just doesn't sit well with people. You know, these are children who have been through horrific situations, many of them. And, you know, it's true. It's not uncommon that these kids will walk away. Sometimes they will try and go back to their natural parents. Regardless of how bad of a situation that might be. But those children are in state custody. The state is essentially their ward. You're responsible for what happens to them. And if they run away, you're supposed to go look for them. You're not supposed to stand in front of a legislative committee and say it's not a big deal. So that's probably what. There had been many other things, as you mentioned. There were a number of legislative post-audit reports that were examining different aspects of the child welfare system and foster care in particular. The legislature finally, you know, put this task force together. They haven't issued any recommendations yet because it was specifically set up so that they won't issue their final report. I think they'll issue like a progress report early in this session, but their final report and recommendations won't come out until January of 2019, when a new administration will be sworn in, because the Brownback administration and Phyllis Gilmore were really resistant to having this task force.
One of the other revelations that came out during those legislative hearings were the number of kids that were spending the night in the offices of DCF because there simply weren't enough foster care homes.
You know, you hate to think about these situations, but they happen. Police will go to a home and remove a child, maybe because they had to arrest the parents or whatever, in the middle of the night, and the child has to go somewhere. We lack a lot of capacity in foster care homes, in group homes like the one here in Lawrence that Gina Meyer Hummel was running. We lack a lot of capacity, especially for emergency placements in those kinds of situations. I heard a lot of legislators, they were frustrated with that, but at the same time, they were saying, thank God those workers are so dedicated that they would do that, that they would go back to their office and be with that kid in their office, as awkward as that was, you know, for a night, just to make sure the kid had a safe place to be.
At one point, during one of these meetings, they had a handout that kind of broke down when these kids have been sleeping in offices and what types of children they are. And, you know, it's also an issue where they have extreme difficulty sometimes finding placements for children who have acute needs of whatever variety. And I thought I saw there was a few instances, or at least one or two, where, you know, a sex trafficking victim had to spend the night in one of these offices. Just the idea that, you know, you've gone through that kind of trauma and now you're being asked to like sleep on a couch or something. It's kind of mind blowing. But I think, you know, that was something that Gina Meyer Hummel really harped on when she kind of gave her opening press conference when she was named DCF secretary. You know, she spent a decent amount of time talking about that. She spent a decent amount of time talking about the missing children and saying she's going to have a report on her desk every morning that says, you know, these are the names of the children and here's kind of an update on what we're doing to try to find them. So I think, you know, at least if Collier made this pick, I think it got through the Collier that, you know, the messaging surrounding foster care was not good at the moment and they needed to do something to turn that around. So I think at least what they're saying publicly is, you know, kind of we hear these concerns and we're working to address them.
Today on KPR Presents, we're previewing the year ahead with Kansas lawmakers, with Jonathan Shoreman of the Wichita Eagle and Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal-World. One of the big stories nationwide over the past couple months has been sexual harassment and the Me Too movement. A Kansas City-based consulting firm, the Women's Foundation, made some recommendations to the policy and the culture of the Kansas State House. Where do you see that going, Peter?
I think that many of those recommendations will be adopted with broad bipartisan support. This all got started when a former Democratic House staffer, Abby Hodgson, gave some quotes to a national news site called The Hill. And they were talking about sexual harassment in state capitals around the country, and she was one who spoke up and said that she had routinely been the victim of sexual harassment on the job. And she also said that legislative interns, who are essentially college students, were frequently pressed into duty after hours to be designated drivers, essentially, for inebriated lawmakers. That lit off alarm bells. All of us picked up on that story immediately. And Senate President Susan Weigel said, one of the few females in leadership positions in the Kansas legislature, she was the one who reached out to the Women's Foundation and got them to come in and take a look. The legislature's sexual harassment policy had not been updated in more than 20 years. And it still allows for things like non-disclosure agreements and mediated or arbitrated settlements, which the Women's Foundation said you should either eliminate or really limit. And it also, there's no mechanism for an automatic investigation. And so these are things the Women's Foundation, their key recommendations were mandatory sexual harassment for legislators, for staff, for interns, and for lobbyists. They didn't mention the news media, but our companies have their own policies on that that are probably stricter than the legislature's. So anyway, these are probably going to go through. They talked about mandatory training and hiring outside counsel to serve as investigators to investigate harassment complaints.
You know, I think this it'll probably take a few months maybe before some of these policies are actually written up and really codified into kind of the legislative policy handbook that I mean, forget what it's technically what its technical name is. But this is clearly a process that's been kicked off. And I agree with Peter. I think a lot of these are going to end up in policies somewhere. And one just maybe one more thing that wasn't mentioned by Peter was there was a recommendation about a non-fraternization policy between interns and lawmakers and lobbyists. And I'm not sure we've really had any, at least public instances of that kind of activity in Kansas, but that was an issue over in Missouri a few years back where the House Speaker over there did resign over some sexually charged text messages that came out that he had exchanged with either a low-level legislative staffer or an intern.
That's one of those things, though, the non-fraternization policy. That's probably going to get dicey. I can see having that, you know, for interns, certainly. But lobbyists are paid, you know, to influence legislators, including taking them out to dinner, hosting, you know, social events for lawmakers. That's their job, is to socialize with lawmakers. And sometimes that leads to possibly inappropriate relationships. But at the same time, you have to think that certainly the lobbyists and the lawmakers are all over 21 and capable of making adult decisions. And you don't really have the kind of power imbalance situation that you have when a lawmaker is flirting with a staff member or flirting with an intern. Sexual harassment is not about sex. It's about power. And the state house is one big brokerage house for power. And so you can kind of understand how it would occur there and why there's a need for very strict policies. I think when that the Hill story came out and we all started doing follow-up stories on that, I personally was kind of surprised. We don't see it normally, but we cover meetings. We cover House and Senate sessions. We do one-on-one interviews. We don't socialize with legislators.
I'd also point out that you're both men.
It's very true.
It's very true. We are the State House Media Corps, however, has added some diversity to it in recent months. The State House reporter for the Capital Journal, Topeka Capital Journal, where Jonathan used to work, is now a young woman named Allison Kite. The KSN-TV group here in Kansas has hired a young female reporter to be their State House reporter. Her name's Courtney. So it is getting a little bit more diverse, and you do see female reporters from the local TV stations in Topeka and from Kansas City are down there frequently. So it's not an all-men's club. It tilts in that direction, I'll have to admit, but it's getting better now.
Okay. Let me change directions a little bit. About 30 states have legalized marijuana use in some form, from recreational use, like our western neighbor Colorado, to medical marijuana. Any chance that Kansas will take up this issue?
So if the question is, will medical or recreational marijuana become law this year, I think, you know, the answer is pretty close to no. You know, I don't predict the future, but the chances do not look good. And, you know, that's no real change from the way it's been in the past. You know, there was the announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that he was rescinding this Obama-era policy that basically told federal prosecutors to not really interfere in states that had legalized marijuana. So it's kind of unclear whether prosecutions will begin again or whether the DEA will and other agencies will kind of more aggressively go after marijuana violations in these states. So certainly that kind of provides a disincentive for states that haven't legalized to maybe they're taking a second look now and saying, do we really want to get into this while, you know, the federal enforcement is uncertain. So you you add that on top of just the fact that these bills in Kansas haven't really advanced in the past. I think a medical marijuana bill at least is fairly regularly introduced every session. And I believe one did get a hearing last year or 2 years ago and got a favorable recommendation from a committee, but, you know, didn't get a floor debate. So we're it's a long ways from, you know, a committee vote to having both chambers pass the same bill and having the governor, whoever that person might be, sign it into law. And I think I just really just don't see that process, someone getting through that process this year.
You know, I think another factor is that the legislature just lost one of its major champions of medical marijuana and medical hemp. That was Representative John Wilson from here in Lawrence, who stepped down at the end of the 2017 session. So he's being succeeded by Eileen Horn, who's been running the city and county sustainability office. I don't know that this is really on her tops on her agenda. It may be. I don't know. It certainly has a measurable support in the legislature, not among leadership necessarily, and certainly not in the governor's office.
Okay. We've got a couple more minutes. I just want to throw it open to you two. What are some issues that you see coming up in the 2018 legislative session that we haven't talked about?
I probably would say prisons. You know, the State Finance Council, which is this group made up of the governor and legislative leaders, is debating a proposal whether basically sign off on a rebuilding of parts of Lansing Prison. And parts of those prison is extremely old, although I think they wouldn't be tearing down the original section that was built pre-Civil War. But anyway. You know, they are debating whether or not to sign off on that project. You know, there was a lot of kind of episodes of turbulence and disturbances within several Kansas prisons this year. And actually, it got to the point where Governor Brownback did issue an executive order raising pay for corrections officers. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on the legislature to look at making those pay raises permanent and whether or not to even kind of increase pay even more. Part of that was largely in response to they were also having trouble just kind of recruiting and retaining corrections officers at some of the facilities. And my impression is that's maybe gotten a little bit better now, but certainly there's a lot of turnover at those facilities.
That project with the Lansing State Prison, it's a $362 million project for a 2,400-bed prison that Core Civic, a private organization, would design and build, and the state would lease it from them.
Yes, the state would. It's basically a lease purchase. At the end of the lease, the state would recoup ownership of the facility. The Department of Corrections is saying this project basically pays for itself because you can staff a modern, well-designed prison with about half the people that it now takes to staff Lansing. One of the things about Lansing is in the maximum security unit, which is in that 150-some-odd-year-old building, it wasn't designed to modern standards, obviously. So it takes a lot more correctional officers to staff that because you don't have clear lines of sight to an entire cell block where one person can monitor, you know, a larger number of inmates. So they say it would save, you know, roughly $23 million over the course of that 20-year lease. Lawmakers, however, are concerned about the plans for reducing staff, and they have some concerns about Core Civic itself because of some litigation that it's been involved in. And it's just a huge project, and they've been, as Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning of Overland Park was saying, they've had to clean up some messes from some big contracts in the past. And he said, I don't want to have to apologize for this one later on. parts of the contract still had not been finalized. He said, I want to fly spec the entire contract, you know, from top to bottom before I sign off on this thing. And everybody else on the Finance Council agreed with him.
So they've delayed that, but we do expect to see some kind of action on that in the session ahead.
The Finance Council is usually only meets in the interim, except that last year's budget bill sort of gave them the final okay on this deal. And so they voted Thursday to delay it for 2 weeks, get all the documents in, get all their questions answered. And then on January 18th, they're supposed to meet again and vote up or down on the project.
Okay. Other issues, Peter?
Gun safety and gun control. That consumed a lot of time in the 2017 session because a new law was scheduled to take effect July 1st that would allow concealed carry in virtually all public buildings, including university campuses like here in Lawrence. They ended up clawing back some of that. Publicly owned hospitals such as Lawrence Memorial Hospital, many cities that own their own nursing homes and other kinds of healthcare facilities, county health departments, they are still allowed to ban concealed weapons inside. But it's still on college campuses, and the universities are still highly concerned about this. Two bills have been pre-filed. They don't have to do with campus safety. One by Representative Boog Heiberger here in Lawrence would make it a crime to abandon a firearm in a public place. That is a response to an incident here on the KU campus when a loaded handgun that turned up to be stolen was found sitting in a men's restroom in Wesco Hall. The other bill by Representative Vic Miller of Topeka would ban the possession of what are called bump stocks, and those became famous after the horrible massacre in Las Vegas in, I think it was October, when more than 50 people were killed and more than 500 people were injured, because the shooter had used these things called bump stocks, which make a semi-automatic weapon behave like a fully automatic weapon. Semi-automatic weapons, you have to pull the trigger each time you fire. Fully automatic, it just continues firing as long as you hold the trigger down. And that's what added to the carnage in that. So he's offered that bill. The thing is, a bill about guns can be turned into any kind of bill about guns with a simple amendment. And so leadership is a little concerned, at least on the House side, about letting these bills go through because they're so easily amendable into broader, wide-ranging gun control legislation, such as repealing campus carry.
Any other issues?
Yeah, we didn't even talk about abortion. You know, we're expecting a ruling really any time from the Kansas Supreme Court over whether the state constitution kind of protects the right to an abortion. There's a lot of talk that if the court rules that the Constitution does not protect that right, or rather does protect that right, that there might be a push to amend the state constitution to explicitly say, no, the Kansas Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion. So that could be potentially, depending on how the court rules, that could be an issue that gets talked about this year.
Every Friday at around 9:30 is when Supreme Court decisions come out, and we're all sitting at our computers looking at the Supreme Court's webpage to see if that decision is there, and it hasn't been. That case was argued, what, back in March?
Yeah.
April of last year?
Months and months ago.
Yeah. So we've been expecting this any time for a very long time.
Okay. Lawmakers return to Topeka this week for the 2018 session. Today on KPR Presents, we've been previewing the year ahead with Kansas lawmakers. I've been joined by Jonathan Shorman of the Wichita Eagle and Peter Hancock of the Lawrence Journal World. Jonathan and Peter, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's been great to be here, Kay.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. Tuesday evening marks the last State of the State address for Governor Sam Brownback. The governor will outline his budget priorities, including his plan for public school funding. Listen to his speech and the Democratic response Tuesday at 5 p.m. on Kansas Public Radio. Live coverage is made possible by Kansas Action for Children. Learn more about KAC online at kac.org.